You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Grocery store shelves, restaurant menus, cookbooks, they're a lot different in 2017 than they were, let's say, 30 or 40 years ago in this country. Americans tend to pay a lot more attention to the food we eat and how it's prepared. We know more about fine wines. A lot of us seek out organic fruits and vegetables and are willing to try the exotic foods that our parents or grandparents could not even begin to imagine. But at the same time, we've seen the income inequality gap widen. So has good food become conflated with high status? And if so, how did that happen? That's the focus of a new book titled Discriminating Taste, written by Margot Finn. She's a lecturer in applied liberal arts at the University of Michigan, and she specializes in food, popular culture, and class. Good to have you back on the program. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the subtitle of this book is really intriguing, How Class Anxiety Created the American Food Revolution. What do you mean by that?
Well, really, it's the idea that class and class anxieties are driving this interest in food that you just described. So the reason that so many people started eating, trying to eat better in all these different ways, which often conflict, right? When you think about, we're going to buy imported wine and cheese, but local produce, or we're going to have gourmet meals, but we're also going to diet, right? There's these things that are kind of at loggerheads. So part of my, you know, my curiosity going into writing this book was why all of these different ways of eating better, especially ones that don't seem to make sense with each other. And the common thread that I found in looking at the way people were talking about these foods and choosing them seemed to be that it was about status, about these anxieties about, you know, and not necessarily always directly about class, but I think class is at the heart of that desire to eat better, to do better.
That old saying, you are what you eat. Is that what we're talking about here?
In a way, I think it, particularly to the extent that that saying reflects for people, some people use it in a way to talk about health specifically, but I think the meaning of the phrase can be quite broad. The idea that, you know, if you know how somebody eats, you know a lot of things about them, their background. And often by background, we really do mean class. But, you know, you can also tell other things about people, their ethnicity, their region, sometimes their religion. There's other things that shape our food ways. But yeah, I think a central part, particularly right now in this moment of extreme income inequality, is that food really says something about your class status.
So you're what? By going and buying expensive organic produce or the best wines, are you saying I'm better than them? And if so, who's the them?
I think there is an act of differentiation at work, particularly with those luxury foods. But one of the trends that I find really fascinating is, and this has been talked about in music too, but in food, we've seen a move towards omnivorousness. So it's not just, oh, the rich people are going to eat all the expensive fancy foods. Often now people express their status by saying that, oh, I eat everything, right? I like everything. And I think part of what's going on there is it's a disavowal of snobbery. It's a move away from this kind of old school, oh, the rich eat, you know, all the fancy stuff. Now people are going to, they might have the fancy wine, the fancy cheese. Sometimes they'll go to the expensive restaurants, but they're also, and they're going to be really proud of this, right? They're going to go find the most exotic underground food. They're going to eat the food truck. They're going to find the pop-up. They're going to talk about how they really actually love American cheese. And that in some ways is a way of justifying, like, look, it's not just that I'm a snob. I like good food wherever it's from. So it's that kind of gesture towards a democratic taste. But I think that omnivorous itself is in some ways now a sign of status, because if you're truly poor or don't have the ability to kind of seek out this whole range of things, then you're not going to have an omnivorous diet, right? You're not going to be able to signal your breadth of taste. You might have actually a very limited parochial taste that's governed more by you got to eat what's familiar, what's available to you. And you don't have the option of, I'm going to try this thing, and if I don't like it, you know, I'll just not finish it, because you don't have the luxury of just throwing away money on food you might not like. So I do think that it's not just about the fancy stuff, but different ways that even just, you know, having a whole range of tastes might signal that you've got privilege.
I'm talking with Margot Finn, who's a lecturer in applied liberal arts at the University of Michigan. Her book is Discriminating Taste, How Class Anxiety Created the American Food Revolution. What are the four ideals of the food revolution?
The four that I talk about primarily are the idea of sophistication, and so that's the kind of fine wines and cheeses. The ideal of thinness, which I think is really central to our perceptions of what is healthy. The idea of purity, which by that I'm talking about the kind of natural foods movement. And the reason I use the word purity is in part because that was used in the Gilded Age to talk about some of the same concerns, ideas about food that is free of pathogens, and also that might, you know, the kind of whole grains movement of that moment, I think, goes along quite nicely with the trend towards an organic, natural idea about food, local, sustainable, all that kind of gets encapsulated by the term purity. And the fourth would be cosmopolitanism, or the interest in diverse ethnic foods.
In fact, speaking of this historic parallels, you dig into the Gilded Age. So compare and contrast for us.
Sure. Well, what was fascinating to me is I think maybe like some other people, when I got into this project, I thought that all of these trends that I was talking about were pretty new. I thought that these were, you know, there, maybe there were some inklings in the 80s, but it was really the 90s where it got big. And before that, you know, we had, I don't know, processed cheese and cake mixes and whatever.
I am a child of the 50s, and I remember the green Jell-O cubes with the weird things in there. And,
yeah, Jell-O salads, casseroles. The kind of, you know, that we had kind of down-home American cooking. And then it was in the 80s that we take off with all this fancy stuff. But when I looked at a longer historical timeline, it turned out that in, you know, roughly the period 1880 to 1920, a lot of the things that seem very familiar to us in terms of concerns, although they might have manifested differently, were really mainstream, and they were particularly a concern for the upper middle classes. So you see people starting to give really elaborate dinner parties with multiple courses, often, you know, with nods to French cuisine in that period. You also see the real emergence of weight loss dieting in America in that period. So people, and slimming was the term typically used at the time. So slimming diets were big. You also saw the pure foods movement emerge, right? People being really concerned about where their food is coming from and is it clean? Whole grain diets. And you also saw ethnic food, people getting really excited about different kinds of ethnic foods. There were Japanese teas were a popular way to entertain, particularly for the upper middle class. So there's a kind of, you know, people now talk about it as Orientalism, a real interest in the East, but it was broader than that too. There was an interest in all kinds of ethnic foods and having these cosmopolitan dinners that would showcase your geographical knowledge.
How did we retreat? Was it World War II? Was it the Depression?
I think it's the Depression. Mm. I mean, I would think that because I think it's tied to inequality. And it's really the Great Depression that crashes the fortunes of the ultra rich and where you see the compression in income inequality. But I do think that all of these and other historians who look at food have argued that these things do seem to recede at that moment. You do see a decline in the popularity of slimming even. So weight loss dieting declines and you get changes in beauty ideals, right? So there was kind of the flapper and the Gibson girl slimmer figures. And then we get a return to the more voluptuous body. So you do see this kind of, you know, I think 30s to 70s, you had a real retreat from all of these trends.
So where might this phase we're in go? Where do you see it going?
I hate predicting the future. So I started writing this dissertation around 2007, 2008, so right before the big financial crash. And I haven't been able to devote a lot of attention to what has changed since then. It's always hard to analyze your contemporary moment. I do think that probably it may have changed some things. And at the same time, because income inequality hasn't shrunk at all, my feeling is that there's still actually a lot of pressure to aspire through your consumption practices, that people are still not gaining, the middle classes in general are not gaining economically. So that there's still those kinds of, the same kinds of pressures that have existed since 1980, I think, are still weighing on the middle classes. So I don't know if it's really changing, but would it? I guess my prediction would be if we can shrink inequality, then we might see less concern about eating better in those kinds of ways. That would be my prediction. Yeah. But I don't know if inequality is going to shrink.
Fascinating stuff. And it makes you stop and think about what it is you reach for when you go shopping or when you're eating out. And just the one other thing I wondered, how much of it is just someone who's trying to choose to eat healthy because we know so much more than we did 3-4 decades ago about disease and what can cause disease. How much of that is, I just want to be healthy, not so much that I'm trying to prove I'm better or kind of flaunt it a little bit?
I would say for individuals, it might often be, and I think this is true of, you know, whether you're trying to eat something that you think is tastier, whether it's healthy, whether you want to really explore some kind of other ethnic cuisine. I don't think it's coming from a place of like, oh, I'm going to show off, right? Not consciously, explicitly. But with the health thing, I think it is interesting that I think a lot of people are trying to eat healthy, and it is based on having some pieces of information, but it's not like there's one coherent, you know, I don't know that any of us really know what it is that we could eat to have optimum health.
Oh, I agree. In fact, you know, the diet plans come out in there and at loggerheads with each other quite often.
Look at paleo versus vegan, right? Or the plant-based diet. So I think that there is no one ideology that, and even nutritionists, people who study this don't necessarily agree all the time on what exactly it is we should eat. So I don't think that these trends, any of them, including the health food trend, is really driven by an enlightenment, right? Like, oh, now we know better than we did 30 years ago. We know some things that we didn't know 30 years ago, but I don't think it's translated into, I know exactly what I could eat to be healthier.
A great and fascinating look at the food we eat, the choices we make. The book is Discriminating Tastes, How Class Anxiety Created the American Food Revolution. Margot Finn, lecturer in applied liberal arts at the University of Michigan. Great to talk with you.
Thanks so much.